Hey, Charlotte Talks fans. How do you listen to the Charlotte Talks podcast? Take our 5-minute survey right now on WFAE.org. We appreciate it.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In the Erica Parsons murder case in Rowan County, the death penalty is in play. It's also on the table in a case involving the murders of 4 state prison workers. But it has been more than a decade, 2006, since North Carolina has executed anyone. And last year, juries rejected the sentence in 4 different cases. That follows a national trend, with fewer death sentences being carried out and with public support, as measured in a recent Gallup poll, at a 45-year low. Charlotte attorney Henderson Hill is a longtime critic of the death penalty and is spearheading a campaign to have the U.S. Supreme Court take another look at its constitutionality, even though this spring the High Court declined to look at Arizona's death penalty system. Henderson Hill is with us this hour to talk about his reasons for opposing the sentence. He is executive director of the Eighth Amendment Project, which helps to coordinate litigation strategies and drive litigation and policy. Or legislation and policy, as well as electoral strategy around capital punishment. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. Also with us is Elizabeth Hamburger, staff attorney at the Center for Death Penalty Litigation in Durham. She's also been representing people facing death sentences in state and federal proceedings since 2004. Thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
You can join the conversation on Facebook or Twitter through email at charlottetalks@wfae.org, Twitter at Charlotte Talks. You can watch us this morning on Facebook Live as we come to you from our mothership studio here at the university area. How many people are sitting on death rows right now across the country or in North Carolina, Mr. Hill?
Well, Mike, right now I think the count nationally is about 2,800. It could be a little bit higher, 2,830, and it shifts really by the week.
Why? If they're not handing out death sentences, why does it shift?
The trend is they shift down.
Okay.
So prisoners die. Prisoners get relief from court. In fact, that's the most common explanation.
Okay.
You know, an appeal gets processed and you get released. In Pennsylvania, for example, 2 or 3 years ago, death row was at 188. I think it's now something like 153. And there hasn't been an execution during that time. But the courts have looked at these cases and increasingly have seen errors that require relief. And so that row is dropped. Yeah, considerably.
Are all of the people on death rows across the country there for murder?
Yes.
All of them. Are those on death row in the United States and in North Carolina disproportionately African American?
Well, certainly the percentage of people on death row is much higher than the percentage of African Americans in the population in North Carolina and nationally. I don't know the number specifically. Do you, Henderson?
Yeah, the stat traditionally revolved around 55 to 60% African American, which compared to the population was way out of sync. Notably, there has been a shift in the pace in which some death row populations get executed. And there's a political piece to which case gets pushed ahead to the head of the line. And sometimes one suspects there's motivation behind that.
I suspect on your part it's more than a suspicion.
Yes.
You wrote, Elizabeth, in the Raleigh News and Observer, that you spent 5 weeks in a courtroom there listening to people talk about the death penalty, only to have the jury vote unanimously to hand down a life sentence for your client, Nathan Holden, the ninth life verdict in a row. That's hard to say. You weren't surprised, you said. Is that because public opinion has been turning against capital punishment, or were there other factors involved in this particular case with this particular courtroom?
Well, before the trial began last January, I certainly was aware of the fact that that polls were showing reduced support for the death penalty in the state and nationally. But I was still really surprised when I sat down in the courtroom and began to actually hear the views of the people who were coming in for jury service. So what happens in a capital trial is random people who are summoned for jury duty are called into the courtroom, and as a necessary part of the process, we have to ask them really detailed questions about their views about the death penalty, because that's for certainly for us on the defense side, that's the main criteria we use for deciding who we want to use our peremptory strikes on. Those are sort of discretionary strikes that we can use against to select a jury. Mm-hmm. So both sides ask a lot of questions about the death penalty, and I was pretty stunned when we just started talking to person after person, and I could really tell that the message that we've been trying to get out for years about the problems with the death penalty was really resonating with people. I was hearing people say back to me things which I feel like I'd been saying for my whole career. We heard back, I heard people talking about the racism in the system, about discrimination, about innocence, about their fears that the death penalty couldn't ensure that we couldn't ensure that it was handed down fairly. Those were the sorts of things that people were saying, and we were hearing from very few people who were adamantly for the death penalty. I would say the majority seemed at best ambivalent, because on both sides we're able to. Both sides are able to use these peremptory strikes and jury selection to remove people who have either a very strong, the state would remove people who have a very strong anti-death penalty stance, and we would remove people who have a strong pro-death penalty stance. It just became clear pretty early on in jury selection that the state wasn't going to be able to find 12 people who were pro-death penalty enough to hand down a death sentence in this case.
Well, that goes to the national poll that I mentioned, the Gallup poll that said it's at the 40. Support for the death penalty is at a 45-year low. But in the course of talking to those potential jurors, they told you why. Mm-hmm. What seemed to be the overriding reason? Is it the mistakes that we have seen crop up? Is this coming from the media, their information from the media? Is it coming from a PR machine, anti-death penalty PR machine? What's it coming from?
Well, interestingly, that Gallup poll that you described also showed that within a year, the support for the death penalty among conservatives dropped 10%. And that's because conservatives have been looking at precisely what you mentioned, exonerations. The government doesn't seem to do a lot of good things well. And conservatives and libertarians, that's a principal part of their ideology. If they can't deliver mail, if they can't teach school, if they can't deliver health care, what makes you think a government process is going to identify those deserving of death versus those who should be sentenced to life?
Yeah, I'm trying to find it in my notes. I know that you said that a lot of the lack of support is coming from a place that many people may not suspect, and that is from conservatives, from evangelical Christians, from fill out the list because I can't find it in
my
notes.
Well, just because of the operation of the death penalty system, folks are spending 10, 15, 20 years on death row. And what we've known is the person that gets executed is often a very different person than the person that committed the crime or that was convicted. That person has been isolated, taken away from community, no longer a danger, and is almost forced to go through introspection about who he is and how he got there.
But
and that creates change.
Yeah, but the person who lost their life at the hands of this perpetrator, they don't change. That was the moment that it ended. So how do you make up for that?
That loss is something that can't be brought back. That's a loss that the family, that the community has felt. And frighteningly, 14,000 families go through that every year. You know, this country has a violence record that's daunting. Out of the 14,000 murders, only 30, 40 receive the death penalty. So there are families out there who are in need of justice. Justice does not require the death penalty. And what we're finding increasingly is that the death penalty itself retards the delivery of justice. And that's what increasingly families are feeling, conservatives are feeling, and the sense that there's violence out there. We need to be thinking, what's the appropriate response to violence? And it comes to that basic thing we teach our kids. You know, it's kind of weird to think that you teach the community that violence is bad by killing people in response to violence. There's a disconnect there. And I think for society's point of view, it would be helpful for us to have a more cogent response to violence and the causes of violence.
You mentioned a lot of people who have changed their mind about the death penalty and now feel it's not the right way to go, have done so because they're seeing these cases, these verdicts overturned by courts around the country. What seems to be the overriding cause of those verdicts being overturned? Is it the introduction of new evidence through technologies that didn't exist, like DNA testing? Is it because the court finally takes a look at how the previous case was tried and they see irregularities or they see unfairness or they see incompetence? What's the primary reason for these being overturned?
My goodness, all of that feeds into it. But here in North Carolina, we had Henry McCollum and Leon Brown, who spent 30 years in prison on death row for Henry McCollum for a crime they didn't commit. Nationally, 160 people have been in that position where they've been condemned to death for crimes that they did not commit. So that really shakes people in a very fundamental way. Mm-hmm. And I think that is really what has moved the needle nationally.
Elizabeth, you quote a fellow named Brian Stevenson, who was on 60 Minutes last night. He's a lawyer, social justice activist, founder and executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative. And he was on with Oprah Winfrey last night. And he mentioned that over 100, I think it was 100 people got off death row, I think, in the last year or so, because maybe it's a little longer than that, because they were innocent. Mm-hmm. They were found innocent upon review. But he said, you quote him as saying, it is less a question whether a killer deserves to die than whether the state deserves to kill. Is that because of our track record in being accurate and fair in this penalty?
Yes, in part. I think 9 people have been exonerated in North Carolina off of our death row for because they were innocent, because they didn't do it. And that's been for a variety of reasons. And they've been exonerated in a variety of ways because there's lots of ways for these cases to go wrong. And I think, can we trust the state to hand down this penalty fairly? And the more time I spend in this system, the conclusion I come to is that there's just no way for a system that's run by human beings with human emotions and human fallibility to ever be able to impose a sentence reliably when what's at stake is so enormous. And we see that over and over with the mistakes that we see in these cases.
But because
another piece to what Brian Stevenson says about whether we deserve to kill. 20 years ago, I mentored a middle school in Durham. Teacher showed me her closet where there were pictures of every child in her last year's class. She gave me the backstory, the social history of those kids. And she said, Mr. Hill, in 10, 15 years, some number, 10 of those kids will be your clients. It was predictable just because of the social history that these children were going through and the lack of community response to their needs, whether it was educational, whether it was health, whether it was mental health, whether it was abuse, that some part of the system knew, recognized, but none of it was being addressed. When that child then turns 18 or 19 and gets caught up in a horrible crime of violence, the response then is to kill, to execute. Yeah. Do we deserve to kill? Yeah, is a troubling question when you look at the life story of some of the persons accused of these terrible crimes.
And also considering the historical legacy from which the death penalty was born, it's very much rooted in our racial legacy, in lynchings, and the death penalty is much more prevalent in Southern states, was instituted by Southern governments with a history of racial discrimination. And that's another reason, I think, that, does the state deserve?
We have to take a break. Mm-hmm. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking this morning to Henderson Hill, who's the executive director of the Eighth Amendment Project, and Elizabeth Hamburger, a staff attorney for the Center for Death Penalty Litigation. They'll both be having this conversation amongst themselves or between themselves tomorrow night at 6:30 at UNCC's Center City campus. We'll have information about that on our website at WFAE.org. Since we don't have anybody here who is pro-death penalty, let me play devil's advocate from time to time in this hour, where it's sometimes difficult to determine guilt in any case, but particularly where a life is in the balance here, but where we know beyond a shadow of a doubt that this person accused of a crime actually did it, because we have countless eyewitnesses, because we have police testimony, because we have video in some cases of the person actually pulling the trigger or killing the person involved. In those cases, does that change in any way whether the state has the right or deserves to take a life?
Well, I mean, those are actually the most typical cases that I work on in my career as a death penalty attorney, is that most of my clients did do it. And that's true when you're talking about the decline in death sentences handed down by juries. That most of those cases are cases where the jury found the defendant to be guilty of first-degree murder, but decided that life was the appropriate punishment. I think the question is really, once you when you hear about a crime and the only thing you know is this person did this horrible thing, it's very easy to say, well, that person doesn't deserve to live. But what we do in these death penalty trials is we put a face on the defendant. Mm-hmm. We do a really, really detailed social history, and we learn about their backgrounds. And when juries hear the stories, the life stories of these people, as Henderson was referencing earlier, what juries decide is that their lives do have value.
People have a very difficult time sometimes with understanding how attorneys can represent somebody who has committed a heinous crime. But in America, under our Constitution, everybody has the right to a defense. That doesn't necessarily mean that the attorney involved believes that the person ought to get off, but your job is to get them off of whatever the penalty is going to be. Did you come to your own conclusions about the fairness of and the justice of the death penalty in the course of doing your job defending people, or did you have that coming into it?
Well, I think my reasons for opposing the death penalty, I was always opposed to it, but my reasons have really changed a lot. I think now I've recognized that I've never sat down across from a client, sat down across from another person who was who may have done something terrible, and it's never yet happened for me that I've gotten to know that person and I think that they deserve to die. Hmm. The people who I meet who are on death row are really not that different than the people who I meet out in my everyday world. There is no, you know, cookie cutter idea of a murderer. They're not criminal masterminds. They're people who are flawed, like all of the rest of us are flawed. And the thing that is almost always universally true is that they are people who were damaged to some usually great extent in childhood by poverty and trauma and abuse and often mental illness and often very serious substance abuse problems. Things that happened to them when they were very young in their formative years, that's not something that they chose, that anyone would choose. And it led them to a point where they did something, usually something very impulsive, often fueled by substance abuse, that was a terrible choice to make. But, you know, we do all make terrible choices at some point in our lives.
I guess we came to the use of the death penalty because of eye for an eye out of the Bible, and also because people just wanted justice. They wanted retribution. Which is worse for the perpetrator, the death penalty or life in prison? Which do they fear most? Which is the greater punishment?
I'd say two things. One thing that's important to say is it just doesn't factor in the killing itself, in the crime itself.
Of course not.
So the question of deterrence doesn't figure in the calculation. The other thing I'd say is that our death penalty system is really divorced from the biblical mandate life for a life. When you look at the history of the death penalty in North Carolina and the United States, there's a direct overlay with racial terrorism, with lynching, with the growth of the penitentiary system, with Jim Crow, with the Black Codes, with Reconstruction. You can draw a direct line between the operation of the criminal justice system and the death penalty and the oppression of one particular part of our community. And when you ask the question, how did we get interested or driven to opposing the death penalty? For me, it was really very clear. It was the racial legacy of the death penalty and the operation of the criminal justice system more generally that was something that I felt compelled to oppose.
Right. But answer my question about what they fear most, the perpetrators. Is it worse to kill them in their minds, or is it worse to be locked up for the rest of your life?
I've had that conversation with 18, 19-year-olds, and what they tell me over, kill me. Yeah, I'd rather die than spend 40, 50 years in prison. And it takes an older person to sit down and talk with them about what life can be even in a penitentiary system, how you can contribute to your family, to folks on the outside, to folks within the prison community in a way that's actually productive. And surprisingly, I have had and continue to have these sort of convincing conversations with young men who act rashly that there can be a meaningful existence, even in total isolation from community behind the prison
walls. Let's turn it around. Which gives the victim's family more comfort, life in prison or a death sentence that's carried out?
Well, I don't think victims' family members are a monolithic group. Okay. They're people who come from a lot of different belief systems.
Which is better for society at large, then?
Well, I think the better solution would be maybe moving away from the idea of punishment as retribution. Certainly, society needs to be kept safe, but I would like to see a system that allows people to repair, to offer something back. The way that it works now is that the death penalty basically says your life has no value. Your life is over. You have been exiled from humanity. Mm-hmm. And then we warehouse people on death rows in North Carolina. There's been no executions for 10 years. There are 143 people sitting there who are continuing to have lives on the row and are trying to figure out, how do I contribute? That's what I see over and over again, is people, even though they've been exiled, wanting to contribute, wanting
in what
to
way?
Repair.
That's the first time I've ever heard that. Mm-hmm. In what way do they want to contribute? In what way can they contribute? Whether they're on death row waiting or whether their sentence has been commuted or it's a life sentence to begin with?
Well, I think a lot of them would like to... They'd like to be useful in the world. They'd like to heal the victims' families if they can. I mean, obviously, they know that that's a really difficult thing to do, and I think most of them don't know how you would begin. I don't know how you begin doing that.
I represented a young man who was 18, turned 18 a week before he committed his crime. He's been locked up for over 25 years. He now talks like a PhD. This was a person that dropped out at 10th grade, had never read. Home was unsafe, threatening. The truth is, prison was a place where he has prospered. He's engaged in pen pal relationships with people across the country. He's done more reading. Obviously, he's done more reading for the 25 years than he could have ever thought to accomplish during the first 18 years that he was out in the community.
And you say that one of your arguments against the death penalty is that an increasing number of surviving family members say that the death penalty doesn't serve their needs and, in fact, traps victims' families in a decades-long cycle of uncertainty and court hearings and waiting.
There are a couple of pieces to that. One is you talk with a mother who's lost a child. It's hard for them to think that there's justice by taking another mother's child away. So at that level, there's this inconsistency that's troubling to them. From a very practical point of view, when a person pleads to life without parole or to a life sentence, that person disappears. He's separated. He's taken away. The family has no reminder of that act or of that person. when there's a contested trial and sentencing and appeal, that process will continue with hearing after hearing after hearing for decades.
And it's not just that, but the at that trial, the focus of the trial, because the defendant's life is at stake, the focus of that trial necessarily has to be about the defendant. We have to put on social history. We have a whole phase of the trial which is devoted simply to telling the defendant's story. And we have to do that because the defendant's life is at stake. But it's very painful for victims. They say, why is this not about my loved one? Why are you talking about this defendant? It makes sense that they find that painful. But it's also really necessary in order to have a fair system.
What about closure for the victims' families? Do they achieve closure with a life sentence versus a murder a death sentence?
I think many say that yes, that they do achieve closure with a life sentence.
I think if you think that there are 14,000 killings a year, and 30 or 40 of those are responded to with a death penalty, that's 13,900 families who seek and obtain justice by something short of the death penalty. And those folks are given closure in terms of this constant reappearance of the criminal case, of hearings. All of that disappears the day that person is sentenced.
What about people who commit murders like Dylan Roof, who shot up the Bible study group in the Charleston church, or Nicholas Cruz, who committed the crime allegedly committed the crime in Parkland, Florida? What about them? Both of them certainly have issues. One of them may be mentally ill. Maybe both are. But in the absence of mental illness for a person like that, why isn't the death penalty the right thing for that individual?
In some ways, it's because it masks the harder question. Why does violence occur? And in these outrageous cases, why do these outrageous acts of violence occur? You know, Dylan Roof kills 9 saints because they're black and in a black church. At the same time that, you know, we've been dealing with the Confederate flag in South Carolina for how long? We've got, we have Charlottesville, which sheds the light on the President of the United States blowing the dog whistle on things that most of us thought were done away with. When in fact, there is still this sort of, what Brian Stevenson called, we haven't had this discussion about the narrative of racism, racial terrorism. You know, that's a conversation this country hasn't engaged
in. Well, he said last night that you can't have reconciliation without truth. You have to admit, acknowledge what has happened and who perpetrated it and why before you can come to some sort of...
And that doesn't happen with the execution of a 22, 23-year-old ne'er-do-well, when everyone thinks we can close the book on this outrageous act of violence by executing this 23-year-old. That doesn't answer the question. It doesn't answer the larger question of why this kid is sitting there with all the symbols of hate and racial terrorism beforehand. Families that don't know how to respond to that kind of ideology that seems to be driving a disturbed child.
So let me play devil's advocate again. If you were successful and you get the Supreme Court to hear a case and they say the death penalty is no longer available to you because it's unconstitutional, is this the top of the slippery slope? Is the next thing to go away life in prison without parole? Because some people view life in prison without parole as cruel and unusual punishment.
The conversation, Mike, is what the right response to violence is. And you don't start that conversation by saying punishment is always the response, the appropriate response to violence. I think the question is accountability. How do you hold offenders accountable for their crimes? The question is, how do we promote public safety? Public safety is a product that we all are entitled to. You know, nearly 40% of homicides across the country are not solved. They're open. When you talk about giving families what they need, the best piece of closure is identifying the person responsible for the taking of their loved one's lives. How could we increase public safety? One way is by reducing the use of these expensive, unproductive criminal justice policies such as the death penalty.
Well, that's in line with what Gerald Galloway who says. He's a retired Southern Pines police chief who is now working with a group of law enforcement and corrections officials concerned about the fairness and the efficacy of the death penalty. And he points out that we spend so much time and so much money seeking death sentences in a tiny percentage of cases. We have to ask ourselves, what are we getting for that investment? He called it a broken system where innocent people are sometimes sentenced to death. Which is the argument most likely to gain the most attention? The fact that we spend a lot of money and a lot of it just goes down the drain, or the moral question that we might be putting innocent people to death?
I think it's both.
Right. I mean, some of us come to the question from a moral position. But what I've sort of in the last 20 years saw, it's a lot easier for me to back away from that conversation because people come to a moral place, you know, from different directions on their own. But it's hard not to come to the same position on the public safety question. When Henry McCollum was charged with that killing that he spent 30 years, the evidence of the actual killer was right there at the crime scene. He lived, the actual killer did, 100 yards away. Good policing would have found the actual killer. Bad policing, racial prejudices, abuse of the mentally ill led to the wrongful conviction. So it's less the moral argument. If you talk to a conservative, you talk to someone who traditionally supported the death penalty, they look at that and say, in a horrified sense, how could we have gotten it so wrong? What about our system corrupts the investigative process, corrupts the judicial process to permit that to happen? From a point of jurisprudence, habeas corpus has been destroyed. The notion that errors could be committed at trial, but they're harmless error. And so we live with this system that in industry, you wouldn't accept, you know, error rates of 5, 6, 7%. That would be a crisis. How do you accept the fact that 30 years after the Supreme Court declared race discrimination in jury selection, the fact that it's still commonplace that African Americans are excluded, women are excluded, Catholics are excluded, some part of it because the law permits the exclusion of Catholics and other people of faith.
In North Carolina or just around the country?
Around the country. If you have a principled position against the death penalty, you can be excluded from service. And Catholics increasingly have that position and are excluded.
We have to take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about your effort to have the Supreme Court take another look at the death penalty. Henderson Hill and Elizabeth Hamburger are with us. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the death penalty, whether it should go or stay. Our two panelists here are very much opposed to this. Elizabeth Hamburger is a staff attorney at the Center for Death Penalty Litigation. Henderson Hill is executive director of the Eighth Amendment Project. We'll talk about what that's about in a second. Let me share with you some emails that have come in while we've been talking. Rodney, actually on Facebook, says there is no healing when it comes to the death penalty on either side. Angela emails, my mother was brutally beaten and stabbed to death in January 2017. She was 74 years old, in good health, and was killed by her nephew who was living with her after getting out of prison. She was trying to help him get back on his feet. There is no question of his guilt. Prior to this incident, I was generally opposed to the death penalty because of the racial issues involved. However, this man stole my mother's life brutally and without remorse. He is a danger to society and does not deserve to live, even if it means that he has a life term to examine his actions. My mother is dead, and I want him to pay with his life. I'm sure you've heard some similar stories. What's your reaction? What's your answer to that?
My basic answer is I've never disagreed with a family member about their expression of what should happen. I mean, each individual reacts to these kinds of acts of violence differently. And there's a path of grieving, of hurt, of processing this. You know, my hope would be that in some time, maybe it's months, maybe it's years, victims find that their healing, their renewal happens independent of what happens to the person that, that took their loved one away. To me, that's the healthier response to violence. But I think people get at that in their own way. My sense is that people who, you know, I think the lesson of Charleston, when you looked and listened to the family members who spoke positively, just like this correspondent did about the characteristics of their loved ones, that's the positive message that should be trumpeted at every time. Often the people who are lost as a result of violence are incredible saints. They lived lives where their legacy should be trumpeted about. It should not be the focus of what dark period did this person go through for 20 minutes, which ended up in the snatching of a life.
But how do you get justice then for the people who are suffering because of some act of violence?
You hold the offender accountable. But the holding of an offender accountable does not communicate to the death penalty. It doesn't 14,000 times a year. As a society, we respond to violence in a way to keep communities safe, to register the need for accountability, and to punish. But the death penalty is this extraordinary act, which itself is an act of brutalization, which adds to the trauma that the community experiences. And that, I think, is a message that is just incoherent with what should be the public safety message.
So you are the executive director of the Eighth Amendment Project, and the Eighth Amendment deals with excessive bail and fines and cruel and unusual punishment. It reads, excessive bail shall not be required. There's a problem we've done a program on because we do require it. But excessive bail shall not be required, nor excessive fines imposed, nor cruel and unusual punishments inflicted. And your argument is based on the contention that death is a cruel and unusual punishment. Is that right?
That's correct.
Has this never been argued before the Supreme Court before?
Well, the Eighth Amendment jurisprudence is developing. And one of the principles is what is cruel and unusual will change over time. You know, back when the Constitution was available, draw and quartering was not cruel and unusual. The ripping apart of the body was an accepted form of punishment. And so the question now is whether or not our society has developed to the point where the death penalty is no longer consistent.
So we no longer have an even split on the Supreme Court. It's now five conservatives to four, four liberals. And as you point out, this amendment was written, I think, in 1789 and ratified in 1791. And the founding fathers have very different views on many, 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 many things than we have today necessarily. But there are strict constructionist constitutionalists, many of them on the Supreme Court. Do you worry that they will say, well, the founding fathers thought that drawing and quartering people was okay, so clearly execution by the electric chair or sodium pentothal cannot be cruel and unusual punishment in comparison, so we're going to leave it the way it is?
Well, certainly that is one of the challenges that we have. But what the court has often described is this evolving way of measuring community standards and responses to punishments. And what we have today is 19 out of the 50 states who have abolished the death penalty, either by legislation or by court action. 34 states have stopped using it as a matter of practice. And the question is whether or not that trend continues sufficient for this court to say, well, we have changed as a country in the way we respond to violence. And I think that's where we're getting very close to. Just this last legislative session in New Hampshire, we came close to repealing the death penalty. Both chambers appear to be supported. It passed the Senate. It's in front of the House. The governor there has decided that he will veto if it comes to the desk. But it's that close. Same thing could be reported in the state of Washington. Utah has it under debate. Louisiana. This notion, this reexamination of the death penalty, is it good public policy? Is it cruel and unusual? That's what's happening in the states.
If I'm not mistaken, I think you're planning to make your case to the Supreme Court by focusing on evidence in three areas: how the death penalty is being imposed and implemented less and less often, where it is imposed, there are fundamental problems with the system itself, and the people who end up on death row, you say, are not the worst of the worst, but the weakest of the weak. Let's start with that last statement first. What does that mean?
In recent years, the Supreme Court has excluded from eligibility those who are intellectually disabled. It has excluded from eligibility those who are under 18 at the time of the crime, precisely because in any sort of moral sense, they don't have the same level of culpability. Well, if you look at death rows, 40, 50, 60% of them are composed of people with serious mental illness. You know, most people would look at the behaviors and the history of these people and say the crimes were horrible. But in terms of the individual culpability, these people can't have that same level of moral culpability simply because of the mental illnesses that drive them. And we know that because as a society, we have a hard time dealing with folks with serious mental illness. You know that from your family stories. You know that from your workplace. And our cases are replete with defendants who sought mental psychiatric treatment, was refused, turned away, the wards are too full. And within 2 weeks, they commit this horrible crime. The community is shocked. But 2 weeks before, the community was without the resources to respond.
What are the fundamental – did you want to jump in there?
Well, I wanted to say that that death sentences are not spread evenly geographically across the country or across the state. They the prosecutor is the person with the most power in this equation. And prosecutors are elected officials, and they're just individuals who have different views about the death penalty. Some prosecutors—
And they're elected.
And they're elected, yes. And some prosecutors seek the death penalty at much higher rates than others. So you can commit the same crime in the county next door, and that prosecutor might choose not to seek the death penalty. But the prosecutor in your county will.
Well, that brings up an interesting point. If we're going to have the death penalty, shouldn't there be a universally exercised standard of what qualifies for that, as opposed to this hodgepodge of, I'm not even sure that's the right word to use, that maybe there's no standard. Is there a standard?
Well, this is a fundamental problem about the death penalty. The Supreme Court has been trying for decades to figure out how do you make the penalty both consistently applied, and how do you take into account the individual factors in the case? And I think the problem is you can't really do both.
But isn't that the case in there are people who believe in states' rights. Mm-hmm. Why should my right in North Carolina or my protections under the law in North Carolina be different from somebody in Virginia? But they are. So why should this be any different?
And why should your right in Mecklenburg County, Orange County, Durham County be different than your right in Robeson County, Duplin County, or Guilford County? You know, there's a bizarreness in the way in which the death penalty is imposed. That bizarreness often has a lot to do with the individual prosecutor. The name Joe Freeman Britt is legendary in this state. Why? Because out of little rural Robeson County, Joe Freeman Britt, a orator, 6'6", was able to get 44 notches on his belt. And he was driven to do that, not because the crimes committed in that county were outrageous and required that kind of response. It was because, you know, and he would admit it, he enjoyed the death. He enjoyed the theater of it. And he was successful and good at it. But what that meant was he was riding roughshod over all sorts of constitutional protections and rights of the defendants that appeared.
Is that what you're referring to when you talk about the fundamental problems within the system itself?
That's one part of it. That's certainly one part of it. The focus on the poor and the impaired. It also has a corrupting effect on the institutions. You know, it often draws lawyers, defense lawyers, who by experience and training just aren't equipped to handle these cases and are put in that sort of impossible position to defend cases. I've been a lawyer for 40 years. Many of my best friends, good friends, have been or are prosecutors. But the impact on the prosecution function of this competitive system is really destructive.
Would it be accurate to say that most of the defense lawyers that defend these accused murderers in all cases, in most cases that go to death penalty trials, are public defenders?
Well, most are court appointed, yes. Because
do they have the time and the resources and the talent to defend somebody where the stakes are so high?
Well, North Carolina, I think, I'm a member of the indigent defense system in North Carolina, and I think we have a pretty good one, actually, compared to a lot of other states, but it does not have the resources that it requires. And yes, most capital defendants are represented by court-appointed lawyers because almost universally, most capital defendants are poor and do not have the resources to hire a lawyer.
Why is that? Why are they mostly poor?
Well, it's probably for a variety of reasons. I think crime is murders are probably more likely to be committed by people who have fewer resources and end up in difficult situations in their lives.
Because the murder stems from another crime being committed, like a robbery or something
maybe
like that,
sometimes.
As opposed to willfully killing somebody, intentionally setting out to do that.
Sometimes, or simply people are in desperate situations and have reached a point in their lives where they both are not functioning very well and they somehow end up committing murder. But also, I think it has to do with the ways that maybe that prosecutors see these defendants and discrimination against people who are African-American or people who are in lower class, working class folks. In Wake County, for instance, I think it's been remarkable how a series of white defendants, male defendants, middle-class defendants who were accused of killing their wives were not pursued capitally, pretty horrible cases, whereas a series of black defendants who had committed a variety of crimes were pursued capitally. So I think some of it, whether conscious or unconscious, is bias.
When I first started doing this work some 25 years ago in North Carolina, racial animus was still a part of what we saw. You don't see that so much now in the cases. What you
Does
see
that mean
is
it's
much
not
more.
There?
Well, what you have is, sort of implicit bias. It's a recognition that when you see that young, white, middle class face in front of you, you're less threatened by it. You're much more, it's easier to see the contribution of mental health, alcohol, or some other factor that reduces culpability. When that person has dreadlocks, when that person looks different, when that person comes from the other side of the tracks, implicit bias says you regard that person as more dangerous and your choices are fewer about how to respond.
So your effort to get the Supreme Court to take this up is being described as one of the most ambitious efforts of its kind to date. What will be the process, and how confident are you that in light of the fact that they decided not to hear the Arizona case, that they will hear yours? Or how do you get it to them?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. The Arizona case was brought by a lawyer who was a former Solicitor General of the United States, not what you would call a flag-waving abolitionist. He brought that case. He championed that case because he's looking at the jurisprudence and seeing the end, what should be the end of this policy. And he looks at the practice in Arizona and says, my goodness, Arizona breaks faith with the Supreme Court's decisions in 1977 about how arbitrariness should operate, and all of what has happened over the last 40 years show that a different kind of arbitrariness is in place here. Mm-hmm. Geographic arbitrariness within the state, Maricopa County itself, completely different from the rest of Arizona. There were so many ways in which the operation of the death penalty in Arizona was broken. That's what Neil Katyal, the former Solicitor General, was trying to champion. Our belief is enough lawyers are coming to that opinion in the same way that communities, prosecutors, judges, juries are coming to the position that the system is broken. The Supreme Court, one of the most famous lines from the justices is, the time for tinkering with the death penalty is over. You can try to use duct tape and patches here and there, but the system to its core is broken.
I have 5 seconds. Are you confident that you'll find a way to get them to hear the case?
Yes. I think the time for the death penalty has passed. The question is not if, it's when.
Henderson Hill is executive director of the Eighth Amendment Project. Elizabeth Hamburger, staff attorney for the Center for Death Penalty Litigation. Thank you both for the hour. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you.